Good morning, everyone. Thanks for joining us so early in the morning. Welcome to Consensus or Controversy. Clinical investigators provide perspectives on the current and future clinical care of patients with urothelial bladder cancer. I'm Matt Galsky from the ICANN School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, and I'll be moderating the meeting this morning. This is our faculty for today. They need no introduction, Dr. Andrea Necchi from Milan and Dr. Tom Powles from London. In preparation for this meeting, Research to Practice conducted a survey of this in-person faculty as well as three additional non-panelists, Dr. Friedlander, Grievous, and Rosenberg. Results from the survey will be shown throughout the meeting. Here are our conflicts of interest. And here's the commercial support for today. Research to Practice CME Planning Committee, staff, and reviewers have no conflicts of interest to disclose. This program contains discussion of non-approved uses of agents and regimens. Please refer to the official prescribing information for each product for approved indications. Okay, so we're going to get started. And Module 1, Current and Future Management of Muscle Invasive Bladder Cancer, Dr. Tom Powles.
Thanks, Matt. Thanks for inviting me. Muscle-invasive bladder cancer. I wrote this slide on a plane the other day. I think most of it's broadly correct. I think what I'm trying to tell in this story is three things. Number one is if you look at the study drug and the PD-1, PD-L1 story and the orange and the blue, you can see there's no consistent pattern. These drugs, as far as I'm concerned, from the evidence we've generated, are largely interchangeable. Now, they may not be, but we haven't done head-to-head trials. But unlike kidney cancer, I don't think we're in a position where you can say the PD-L1 inhibitors are more active than the PD-1 inhibitors or vice versa. Number one. Number two, in the biomarker section, you can see in red the biomarker trials where we specifically went for the biomarker, not subset analysis or retrospective data collection. Every time we've done a biomarker trial, it's failed. So let's move on from a PD-L1 biomarker. And the third point is achieve primary endpoint. And I put it to you that there's more green at the bottom than the top. And the further down we go, the earlier it is in the disease, which suggests that earlier immune therapy is probably more active than giving it much later. Now, there are issues there because earlier in the disease, some patients are at lower risk because they're cured with surgery. But nevertheless, the biology suggests that earlier intervention is better. I'm going to start with the nivolumab trial, if I may. This is adjuvant nivolumab, CheckMate 274, muscle-invasive bladder cancer. Some patients have cystectomy. Some do not have cystectomy. Some have neoadjuvant chemotherapy. Some do not have neoadjuvant chemotherapy. Then cystectomy, and then nivolumab or placebo. And you can see a reduction in the risk of relapse, which is statistically significant. Some enrichment in the PD-L1 biomarker, but as I said before, it was an ITT study, not a biomarker trial in this setting. And then when we look specifically at those patients who had muscle-invasive bladder cancer, the ITT population included some patients who had upper tract disease as well. The hazard ratios actually come down a little bit further. Overall survival at this point is not statistically significant, but I think it is clinically meaningful. One of the complicated issues is atezolizumab and pembrolizumab have also done studies in this space and not achieved overall survival either. So there is an issue around overall survival in the adjuvant space. There's another super complicated slide which I'm going to summarize for you very quickly. We've done quite a lot of relatively small neoadjuvant trials with different regimes, immune checkpoint inhibition at the top, TAR-200, chemotherapy, etc. Many people try and compare the pathological complete response rate of these trials. We really shouldn't be doing that because we don't have a consistent method for assessing pathological CR. We're all doing it slightly different ways. So using different analysis on different trial populations in modest numbers, you're going to get a lot of noise in that. What I can tell you from this slide is the following. Single-agent immune checkpoint inhibition and chemotherapy are both associated with a higher pathological complete response rate than not doing it. And then there's been a debate about the right type of chemotherapy to use in the neoadjuvant setting. This debate's been going on for 20 or 30 years. And there's issues about dostarlimab or gemcitabine or even CMV, which was the original regime. There's issues about the number of cycles to be given. Some say 3, some say 4. What I think you need to know is the following. There's never been an overall survival advantage for dostarlimab over gemcitabine or any other regime. Indeed, one regime's never beaten another regime. We did these trials 30 or 20 years ago, and most of those trials have been relatively underpowered, which has meant it's been difficult to determine what's going on. I think most people in the clinical community think that gemcitabine is at least as good as anything else. But if you desperately want to give dostarlimab, I've got no problem with that. The top study there, the VESPA study, did not hit significant overall survival. It was a mixed study of adjuvant and neoadjuvant patients. The bottom study, the Coxon study, was a biomarker trial. Again, it showed no difference this time between dostarlimab and gemcitabine. That leads us to NIAGARA. NIAGARA is the addition of perioperative durvalumab to neoadjuvant chemotherapy. Gemcitabine, a standard control arm, was compared with 4 cycles with the addition of durvalumab. There's that adjuvant period here as well, giving a total of a year of therapy. Here you can see a significant reduction in event-free survival, the curves going apart and staying apart. You can see this population is at lower risk. There are fewer events in this population than the adjuvant nivolumab data I showed you. That's a reflection of the adjuvant nivolumab patients having a higher baseline risk of recurrence. You can also here show a significant overall survival with a 25% reduction in the risk of death, which hasn't been achieved previously, with higher path CR rates, a 10% higher path CR rate. And those patients that achieve path CR, the answer to the question is, if you have path CR, do you have to give the adjuvant nivolumab? NIAGARA wasn't designed to determine that question. It can't determine that question. And the data we have suggests the durvalumab patients do better whichever approach. I wanted to show the adverse event data without too much detail. I think what you need to know is it doesn't appear to complicate surgery, and it doesn't appear to be associated with a lot more toxicity. The addition of durvalumab doesn't seem to make a huge difference from giving the chemotherapy. That doesn't mean it hasn't got long-term life-changing side effects. We know about that with immune checkpoint inhibition. I'm not sure the tools we use are ideal for immune checkpoint inhibition to assess adverse events. But certainly my experience is the addition of durvalumab doesn't make a huge amount of difference to the toxicity. Someone's presenting some data on Sunday looking at circulating tumour DNA in this setting. Please come if you'd like to. I think it's quite interesting. This is the abstract or a subset of the abstract. And essentially what the abstract tells us is the following. Number one is quite a lot of patients are ctDNA at baseline. We know it's about 60% from other trials. We know that ctDNA clearance occurs frequently in this setting with immune checkpoint inhibition and with chemotherapy. And indeed here we show the combination of the two is higher than chemotherapy alone. And then ctDNA appears strongly prognostic at all the time points we're looking at. My feeling is this is going to be incorporated into the disease algorithm relatively soon from a global perspective, but it's not currently able to determine which patients need immune checkpoint inhibition, and it's also not able to determine which patients can stop immune checkpoint inhibition. We actually have more robust data for ctDNA in the adjuvant space. The curve on the right there looks at ctDNA-negative patients who remain negative. So this is not just negative at baseline and what happens. This is a population that are negative who remain negative. And if you're negative and remain negative for a year, the chances are your cancer will not come back. This encourages that monitoring process. And on the left-hand side are those patients who are positive post-cystectomy. And those individuals who are positive have a much higher chance of relapse in dark blue and dark red than those that are ctDNA negative in orange and light blue. And there is a suggestion that if you are CTNA positive and you do get a atezolizumab in dark red, you outperform, sorry, in dark blue, you outperform the red best supportive care arm. So prognostic, definitely. Predictive, maybe. There are other trials called Invigor 11, which looks at this prospectively, and we're going to hear about that trial in the near future. There's also a study called Modern, which I'm going to talk about in a second. You're going to see on Sunday more data on ctDNA clearance, but single-agent atezolizumab is associated with a 20% chance of ctDNA clearance. This is going from ctDNA positive to negative. And indeed, this is the Invigor 11 trial, the prospective study, which we're trying to validate that. So if you're negative and you become positive, or you're negative post-cystectomy, you're randomized to atezolizumab and placebo. This trial has completed its enrollment. I think it's going to be an exciting study. The Modern study is an equally exciting study. It's an important trial because if you're positive, you get nivolumab plus rela, which is a LAG-3 inhibitor, versus nivolumab alone. And this is testing the principle that CTNA clearance is going to be an important endpoint for us moving forwards. So I love this component of it. And then in the CTNA-negative patients, you're randomized to nivolumab or surveillance to define that question. This is a quick summary of what we know to date about the neoadjuvant space prior to the Niagara data. And as I said before, 60% positive at baseline, that drops to probably about 30%, and then post-cystectomy, about 10%. The world's moving on. There's data with toripalimab plus an ADC, not enfortumab vedotin, but disitamab vedotin, which is HER2 plus MMAE. This is a neoadjuvant trial. It's a preliminary analysis. It's not a final analysis, but it's got a path CR rate of 63%. One of my observations of the EV Pembro story was we kept getting these exceptional phase 2 results. Everyone said it would never translate that well into randomized phase 3. And guess what? It did exactly that. And indeed, my feeling is that these neoadjuvant regimes of ADCs plus immune checkpoint inhibition will come up with past CR rates well above 50%. I don't know that. I'm not involved in that process. No one knows the answer to that question. But that's my feeling on how this story ends. And when that happens, and these are trials that are ongoing in that space, when those neoadjuvant trials happen with ADC plus immune checkpoint inhibition, and they are very positive, I think the landscape will change in muscle-invasive bladder cancer for a second time. And of course, enfortumab vedotin is not the only ADC being explored in urothelial cancer. Here is some of the more common ones that we're looking at. And all of these are being explored in combination with immune checkpoint inhibition. I suspect half a dozen of them in combination with immune checkpoint inhibition are better than platinum-based chemotherapy. I don't think EV Pembro is a black swan event. And under those circumstances, we're going to see a major shift away from chemotherapy in this disease. And I think this is where the story actually ends for muscle-invasive bladder cancer. Patients are going to get systemic therapy, ADC immune therapy doublets, ideally personalized. The HER2 story, the DV story, disitamab vedotin, is a biomarker-driven story. The randomized phase 3 only explored patients with HER1-3 positivity. EV Pembro is clearly very active in this space. I think 60-70% of patients will end up in the green or the yellow box where they don't have cystectomy. And those patients who have not gone into a path CR or remain ctDNA positive. And I think on Sunday you will see that being ctDNA positive is a really bad thing in all settings, but particularly after neoadjuvant chemotherapy. I think those patients will be salvaged with other regimes. So a huge amount of development in the last 5 years after 20 or 30 years of almost nothing changing. That's the story of bladder cancer. And muscle-invasive bladder cancer is the place where I think we will cure most patients. I'm very excited to be part of this journey. Thank you for your attention today.
Thank you, Tom, for that wonderful presentation. So we're going to run through some discussion questions, and as mentioned at the introduction, These questions were posed to this group of investigators, and you can see the answers here. On some of these questions, most of us agreed. On others, there's more controversy. So we'll talk through each of these. So this is a 65-year-old patient who presents with hematuria, has a cystoscopy that shows a mass in the bladder, biopsy confirms muscle invasive disease, creatinine clearance is 72, regulatory and reimbursement issues aside, what would you likely recommend? And you can see it's pretty unanimous here for the regimen from the Niagara study that Dr. Powell's described. Neoadjuvant Durva plus cisplatin-based chemotherapy followed by cystectomy, followed by adjuvant Durva. So, Tom, in the Niagara study, was designed and done mostly prior to adjuvant immune checkpoint blockade becoming a standard, at least in some parts of the world. Everyone had recommended neoadjuvant Durva. On the Niagara study, most patients didn't get adjuvant Nevo. So how about an approach where you start with chemotherapy and add nivolumab in the adjuvant setting based on pathological stratification versus this approach? Why favor the neoadjuvant approach?
Matt, I think the way I look at this is the following. I think there are a subgroup of patients who do well, dare I say, are cured with immune checkpoint inhibition in this space. I think that if you're going to give neoadjuvant chemotherapy and surgery with all the toxicity associated with that, the addition of durvalumab doesn't make that much difference. Yes, of course, some patients will get immune-related toxicity, but if you're going to give it in the adjuvant space, they're probably going to get that anyway. I think this early approach means that, let's say it was tomorrow, we saw a patient on Monday morning, we would start immune therapy within 2 weeks. And for some patients, I think that's going to make a big difference. For my opinion, the problem with the adjuvant approach is 4 cycles of chemotherapy and cystectomy probably takes you to Christmas time, and then recovering from the surgery about Christmas time. So 6 months down the line, that period has gone by without the patient getting immune checkpoint inhibition, which I think changes the biology of the disease for some. So I think earlier immune therapy in this high-risk population makes sense, just from a biological perspective. The second thing is, of course, that not all patients are able to get to that adjuvant space. Some patients fall along the wayside, some don't get immune therapy, some don't get surgery, some struggle with chemotherapy. And then thirdly, of course, this neoadjuvant approach has statistically significant overall survival, which is really important from a European perspective, at least. And that's not the case in the adjuvant trials where pembrolizumab didn't achieve that goal, atezolizumab didn't achieve that goal, and nivolumab, although the curves go apart and are attractive, it's not statistically significant at that point. So it's a biological reason and a statistical reason.
Thank you. Andre, yesterday I got this email from a community-based practitioner who said that they saw a patient who had muscle-invasive bladder cancer, sarcomatoid histology. They presented the patient to their tumor board, and the Niagara regimen was recommended. The patient was seen in an academic center nearby, and they recommended that the patient go straight to cystectomy. What would you recommend in that setting?
Thank you, Matt. Good morning, everyone. So it's an intriguing question. So the point of variant histology management is still going to be optimized. What we know today is that when moving from chemotherapy paradigm to non-chemotherapy paradigm, when using in particular when using the immunotherapy backbone for combination therapy, or even immune therapy as monotherapy, we could expand a little bit the population of patients who are likely to respond to the treatment. And we saw, and in my experience, I've seen many patients with squamous cell components, sarcomatoid components, responding pretty well to immune therapy. So it is more than likely, and it is one of the advantages of moving beyond the chemotherapy paradigm towards something else. And this is the reason, basically, why I put the statement of neoadjuvant enfortumab vedotin and adjuvant pembro instead of chemotherapy, pending the data for sure for phase three trials that will be disclosed in the near future, there is a pressing need today from the patient side to overcome the known limitations of chemotherapy and maybe potentially expanding the population who can get systemic therapy. So the ideal goal would be to provide the systemic therapy for all comers, regardless of disease biology, disease characteristics, and patient preference, when putting patient desire all into one single option for systemic therapy.
Thank you. So regulatory and reimbursement issues aside, what would you recommend for a 65-year-old patient with muscle-invasive bladder cancer who has received neoadjuvant chemotherapy followed by cystectomy with postoperative imaging showing evidence of residual disease versus no evidence of residual disease? And maybe we'll also add in pathological features consistent with what's recommended per the CheckMate 274 study. So, Andrea, you had said, let's see, evidence of residual disease, order a ctDNA assay and decide based on the results. So tell us more about that.
Well, it depends on what we conceive as evidence of residual disease, because historically, imaging in the pelvis when using CT scan or even advanced imaging with MRI rises concerns with regards to some cases that may be cases like this with the suspicious persistent disease or suspicious recurrent disease in the pelvis. It is tremendously difficult to dissect, even in centers that have dedicated radiologists, because after a major surgery like cystectomy, it's tremendously difficult to see if there is actually a minimal infiltrating disease. So unless you see clearly a refractory, a recurrent disease, I would be more comfortable with using additional tools, and ctDNA option is pretty well shaped to be a strong additional tool to decide upon further systemic therapy for these patients.
So we don't talk about that a lot because it's a harder context of use for ctDNA to study, but I think in practice I can certainly say that there are these situations where the scans are a little bit equivocal. I'm not quite sure what's going on. A lesion is not biopsiable. And obtaining an MRD-based ctDNA test is sometimes the tiebreaker between knowing whether or not that patient has metastatic disease or not. Based on available data in your own personal experience, how would you compare the sensitivity of serial ctDNA monitoring to that of radiological assessments? So this is kind of along the lines of what I was mentioning. So Tom, you said ctDNA is probably better and more sensitive. Tell us why you say that.
I think we're going to I don't think radiological assessment is very sensitive. so you know, I just think radiology is pretty... I mean, one of my presentations, I talked about T-stage at baseline in the neoadjuvant trials, and T3 and T4 and T2. It's all over the place. So the VESPA study has got 95% T2 disease, whereas, you know, but their relapse rate is about the same in the control arm as the relapse rate in Niagara, which has 60% of patients with above 2T disease. So I just don't think we're doing T staging very well radiologically. I think if you want to do it properly, if you're doing MRI scans, but if you've got T2 muscle-invasive bladder cancer, my preference is just get on with neoadjuvant chemotherapy, and in this case, durvalumab, rather than spend 2 or 3 months doing repeat TURBTs and MRIs and other bits and pieces. This is a disease that's can be lethal for some patients, and starting systemic therapy early is important. So I don't love radiology. Actually, I think what you're going to find over the next 12 to 24 months is ctDNA in every meeting coming out with really strongly prognostic results. I think it's more important than PATH-CR. And I think, again, on Sunday, you'll see that may be the case in some of the data we're going to present. And I think you'll find, particularly post-surgery, being ctDNA positive is a really bad indicator. I mean, almost all of those patients are going to relapse, and almost all of those patients have minimal residual, molecular residual disease.
And in terms of ctDNA monitoring, post-cystectomy, I think most of the data suggests probably about a 3 to 6 month lead time between detectable ctDNA and radiographic evidence of disease, depending on the platform. So certainly more sensitive from that metric. So I think we're going to move on to our next section, speaking about non-muscle invasive bladder cancer. Dr. Necky.
Thank you, Matt. I'm pleased to be here today summarizing you the latest developments in non-muscle invasive disease. This is a relatively new space in which we as oncologists have entered, working quite closely with urologists and reshaping the way we conceive the treatment overall of these patients, and also the way we manage currently at the hospital level or department level the treatment of these patients. There are many and many needs across the disease status, but in particular for non-muscle invasive disease, there are issues related to the availability of BCG treatment up front and the treatment of patients who develop disease recurrence or disease progression while on or after BCG treatment. So the development of newer, effective, and well-tolerated options in this patient population is of primary importance. The vast majority of the diagnoses of bladder cancer are made in a non-muscle invasive space. 75% of the diagnoses are made in a non-muscle invasive disease space. So I would mean that the vast majority of the patients that are diagnosed with this disease will face this kind of issues. We are lucky because we have pretty well shared definitions in the community of uro-oncologists with regards to the standard of care treatment or the minimum requirement for BCG administration, BCG courses, and the definition of an adequate BCG therapy that is an FDA-endorsed definition, the definition of BCG unresponsive high-risk non-muscle invasive disease, and most of the credits to this huge work goes to the BCAN, patient perspective, and the community oncologists and community of geo-oncologists and societies like the International Bladder Cancer Group. In this slide, we just summarize the development, the latest developments that occurred with newer therapies, intravesical, with or without systemic therapy or systemic therapy alone, in treating patients with non-muscle invasive disease, primarily referring to the carcinoma in situ component. We will navigate to the most important data emerging from these studies. The TAR development is one of the latest development of the therapy in this disease. The TAR system is a silicon tube that is put in the bladder and osmotically release a chemotherapy drug in the case of TAR-200, that is gemcitabine, and is replaced, recharged, and put in the bladder via a cystoscopic, via catheter cystoscopic procedure. TAR-200 is being developed in many clinical settings, in particular in non-muscle invasive disease in both BCG-naive and BCG-treated, BCG-exposed, and BCG-unresponsive patient population. There is also TAR-210. That is for one of the first time in solid tumor oncology that we deliver topically a targeted therapy, in this case erdafitinib, a pan-FGF receptor inhibitor, just directly into the bladder via a similar system in patients whose tumor harbor a kind of FGF receptor 2 or 3 genomic alteration. There are trials ongoing. One of the most potentially most impactful trial ongoing is SunRISE-3 with TAR-200, the combination of TAR-200 with the anti-PD-1 and antibody cetralimab, or TAR-200 monotherapy as compared to BCG to treat upfront the patient with the diagnosis of high-risk non-muscle invasive bladder cancer. The trial is going to be concluded, so the data release is expected soon in the next few months. So we'll see if we will be able to move from the BCG paradigm to something different. SunRISE-5 is another study that is providing TAR-200 monotherapy in a bit different population of patients. So the population of patients with BCG-exposed tumors, not just unresponsive, patients that have received, for example, just the induction course of BCG and then develop a disease recurrence, so who were unable to complete the full courses of BCG because of the development of side effects and so on. This is a consistent patient population that is going to be targeted by this clinical trial. And we have more consolidated data in the BCG-unresponsive clinical setting from the SunRISe-1, which is a multi-cohort study, investigated TAR-200 with or without setralimab, with an additional cohort, cohort 4, including papillary disease. But in the rest of the cohort, we are dealing with CIS component, with or without papillary component. And the most robust data have been reported with TAR-200 monotherapy. The CR rate, the clinical complete response rate, so absence of any residual disease at cystoscopy and biopsy during treatment was the primary endpoint. And the rate of CR at the latest update presented at the AUA in plenary session this year rises up to 82.4% CR rate. That was much higher than the CR rate, for example, reported with the Pembro monotherapy. Pembro is approved by FDA as an option in BCG unresponsive patient population. The CR rate is just above 40%. And the other important point is that most of the CR here seem to be maintained over time. So the duration, the 12-month duration of clinical complete response is pretty much compelling as compared to Pembro monotherapy or nadofaragene intravesical therapy. There are two standard of care options that have a 20% projection of keeping the bladder intact, 20% projection or even less complete response rate at 1 year. So the durability of the outcome, not just the rate of clinical CR that you see at interim endpoint, is very, very much important. Then this input TAR-200 has been pretty well positioned to become a new therapeutic option in this patient population. And the other point, and the urologist and patient population tell us that this is quite more important as compared to the metastatic setting, the tolerability. So managing 10% grade 3-4 immune therapy related side effects of pembrolizumab is normal practice for me, for Tom, for Matt. But it's I realized it was tremendously concerning for the urologist in order to expose the patient to this excess of toxicity that is avoided when dealing with intravesical therapies. And there is, as I mentioned, cohort 4, also with papillary disease, a very special population without CIS component. There is no standard of care in patients who have a papillary tumor unresponsive to BCG. And data with TAR-200 in this patient population are likely interesting, though biased by small numbers. So there is a filing ongoing, and there is discussion ongoing with FDA with regards to the possibility of putting or having TAR-200 at least in the CIS population as a potential new therapeutic option in this patient population. We have other movements in this space, and the adenoviral gene therapy that is called the cretostimogene in this same patient population is being investigated in the BOND study. The BOND 3 trial was the more mature study that has provided data, the latest data updated at the AUA last year with this monotherapy. This is again an intravesical therapy. The CR rate is pretty much the same line on the of TAR-200, 74.4%. 75% and 74% lasting at least 6 months. So the drug is still equally or likely equally well-positioned as compared to TAR-200. The point that may impact somehow the generalizability of the results is that this trial is a U.S.-based study as compared to an international, intercontinental study like SunRISe. This could rise a few concerns with regards to the geographical variability of responses, geographical heterogeneity of the patient population, and so. But the drug is still there, and the drug is important in this disease. And we have also a trend from multiple companies, for multiple drugs to shift intravenous administration into the intravesical administration with patients with minimally infiltrating disease, like non-muscle invasive disease. This is the case of EV, EV-104, PI is Ashish Kamath here, and the data are still pending. We have very preliminary safety data that put the drug is pretty well shaped to be administered intravesically, but we are still waiting for more mature data from this trial. And we have an opportunity to target FGF receptor 3 genomic alteration here. Much more opportunity here That's compared to muscle invasive disease and metastatic disease. 25% of the patients, or even more, have any kind of two or three mutation here, so a potentially druggable by targeted therapy. And we do have erdafitinib in metastatic setting that is approved in the United States and Europe and in other countries as a standard of care therapy, oral therapy, in patients with advanced disease with the FGF receptor, with a panel of well-selected FGF receptor 2 or 3 genomic alteration, mutation or fusion. Erdafitinib was tested in THOR-2 study as an oral therapy as compared to an intravesical therapy, intravesical chemotherapy in patients with BCG unresponsive disease. Going back to the issue of safety, the trial was positive. The primary endpoint of relapse-free survival was met by this study, by erdafitinib, but actually the results, primarily due to the side effects rate reported in this trial, have not been absorbed by the community of urologists. They've been potentially applicable to everyday practice. TAR210, for sure, could be pretty well, pretty better position in terms of side effects rate. The initial data from the first human study are very preliminary, and there are studies like Moonrise 1 and Moonrise 3 that are larger studies, phase 3 studies ongoing, that may shape another opportunity for patients with mutation in the near future. You see here that the dose of the drug that is absorbed systemically when administered intravesically is minimal. So the way you are exposing patients with the systemic side effects of is minimal when administering with TAR210 intravesically. And the data for TAR210, again, should be taken with a grain of salt because they are very preliminary, but the duration of responses with the duration of CR in these preliminary patients look quite promising for potential expansion in the near future, and the safety data are equally important. So in conclusion, I would like to summarize this important feature. There is a struggle between intravesical therapy and systemic therapy with regards to the CR rate that has been reported. So the struggle here is moving towards intravesical therapy, clearly. This summary is a summary slide of a 6-month or 12-month duration, blue or orange bar, from the different studies using intravesical therapy, monotherapy, or a combination of systemic therapy. You don't see any major difference with regards to duration of therapy between in intravesical therapy studies or combination therapy studies. This means that intravesical therapy is pretty better shape as compared to combination therapy to treat or to become in the near future the therapeutic option for this patient. And just mentioning the possibility to expand a little bit to minimally infiltrating muscle-invasive disease, the possibility to treat the patients with an intravesical therapy. This was reported with SunRISe-4, with TAR-200 in combination with tralimab, or CORE-2 with the cretostimogene and nivolumab combination. The PAT-CR rate is pretty much compelling in this study, so we'll see if we'll be able to expand a little bit the population of patients who are likely to be treated and cured, and potentially saving the bladder with the newer intravesical therapy. So the conclusion are already inside of the presentation. Basically, here the very interesting point here is a struggle between intravesical therapy and the systemic therapy, or the combination of the two. So urologist against oncologist, the struggle is being led by urologists in this case, and intravesical therapy are clearly better positioned as of today to become newer therapies in this patient population. But as a fundamental value here, patient expectation has risen. Patients have risen the bar substantially for the success, and they're asking us to provide anything new as compared to radical cystectomy as the only benchmark for therapy. Thanks.
Thank you for that whirlwind tour through non-muscle invasive bladder cancer. That was great. Thank you. So we're going to just have time for one of these discussion questions, and I think this was a theme throughout some of the discussion questions in a theme of your talk. So maybe I'll pose this to Tom because I think I understand your position on this from your talk. Tom, do you feel like there's any role for systemic therapy in the treatment of non-muscle invasive bladder cancer?
That's a good question, Matt. So look, there's a study called, there's the pembrolizumab license, which is used in BCG refractory disease. There's also two trials. There's a CREST study There's also the POTOMAC trial, which is tocilizumab plus BCG induction maintenance or durvalumab plus induction maintenance. We know they're both positive for event-free survival. We know the result of the CREST study, tocilizumab, has a EFS rate in BCG-naive disease of 0.68. Neil Shore presented that at ASCO, at AUA. There's going to be some data presented later today looking at the CIS subgroup and the T1 subgroups with maybe some enrichment, hazard ratio 0.53 in some subgroups. The first slide I showed was around early immune therapy, that slide with the green and the complicated slide, showing early immune therapy really helps some patients. The challenge for me, speaking frankly, Matt, and I'm going to show some data about this later today, the PD-L1 biomarker is not identifying those patients. There are some patients with non-muscle invasive bladder cancer with potentially lethal disease or problematic disease. I do think immune therapy is the best way of curing those patients. I genuinely mean that. But I'm not clear that we know how to identify them best yet. And treating unselected patients, many of whom aren't clearly in harm's way from a mortality perspective with drugs with life-changing toxicities associated with problems. So there is a balance here. Early immune therapy, I think, is important. But have we absolutely defined it in non-muscle invasive bladder cancer yet? I'm not sure the answer to that question.
Thank you.
Do you agree?
I agree. I think we need biomarkers for risk stratification. I think it ultimately comes down to a pretty simple proposition, which is that we're trying to address a local problem with a systemic therapy. And as you point out, you know, people throw around the number of maybe about 10% risk of metastatic disease in patients with T1, high-grade T1 disease, right? And so that's not insignificant. It's not insignificant for those patients, but we need to better identify who those patients are.
And Matt, what do you tell patients about life-changing toxicity in this space? So you say 10% risk of metastatic disease, that's frightening. We all agree with that. What do you say to patients about the chances of having life-changing toxicity with immune checkpoint inhibition?
I mean, a cystectomy is, for some patients, life-changing toxicity.
Yeah.
If you look at the 90-day mortality rate from cystectomy in the United States and understanding that there's been regionalization of care, so this doesn't apply to many of our centers, but it applies to many patients, the 90-day mortality is 5 to 7%. And so it's not insignificant, and so there are trade-offs here, and there are trade-offs with the risk for lifelong thyroiditis versus 90-day mortality from cystectomy, and so I think we have to take those decisions on a patient-by-patient basis.
But one quick question. Why do you think that Pembro in the United States is still very infrequently used by oncologists or urologists in BCG-unresponsive population? Is it primarily due to the safety concern or to the efficacy results?
I think both. I think when you showed a beautiful slide with CR rates, with treatments that are administered into the bladder with low rates of systemic toxicity, and so using a systemic therapy with a lower response rate and a higher risk for toxicity is not a favorable proposition for most. Now, there are scenarios where it's certainly applicable, and you'll hear our urology colleagues say that if they know a patient's bladder is not going to be well-suited for an intravesical approach, and we know many of our patients after multiple TURs have that issue, having a systemic therapy as a backup rather than going straight to cystectomy is an important option still. Okay, so let's take this one. TAR-200, would you like to be able to access it today? BCG unresponsive non-muscle invasive bladder cancer, you have all of the drugs that you showed on your last slide. Which are you recommending for your patient?
Well, I would say yes for the CIS component. Well, but for non-CIS, we realize, and we are discussing this issue many times in all our meetings. We actually need a comparison with what is actually the standard of care therapy. So we have good data, single-arm data for TAR-200, also in the papillary population, very, very much compelling. But we actually need to have some kind of adjustment with what is actually the standard of care. This was the same for Pembro. Pembro, in the CheckMate 757, was also disclosed with the results in this patient population with papillary disease, non-CIS. But the main criticism related to this study, to the Pembro data, was related to the fact that there was a lack of a comparison with standard of care therapy. So good for TAR-200, but for papillary tumor, we will need a randomization with standard of care.
Thank you. So we're going to move on to the last module and talk about metastatic urothelial cancer. So this is our contemporary algorithm for treatment of metastatic urothelial cancer, and we used to speak a lot about this distinction between patients who are cisplatin eligible versus ineligible, and thankfully that has largely gone away because that was never a scientific proposal, that was a pragmatic proposal, and now we have therapies that are applicable across our patient populations, specifically enfortumab vedotin plus pembrolizumab as frontline treatment. I'm going to speak about some of that data. In the second line setting after upfront EV Pembro, of course, we have an evidence void. And this is a space where we don't know exactly what to do and are using largely by default platinum-based chemotherapy, although, of course, never studied specifically in that setting. We don't have a lot of quote-unquote targeted therapies in urothelial cancer, but we have two actionable targets now, and I'm going to speak about those briefly. So for about 30 years, there was not a single new drug approved by the FDA for the treatment of metastatic urothelial cancer. And then things really started to change with the introduction of immune checkpoint blockade. And that led to more phase 3 studies being done in frontline metastatic urothelial cancer in about a 5-year period of time than were done in the prior 20 years before that. And these are really important studies. These four studies really taught us incredibly important lessons about how we sequence therapy and how we best integrate immune checkpoint blockade. And to summarize many, many years of work on this slide, single agent immune checkpoint blockade is upfront therapy for urothelial cancer, probably doesn't have a great role. And I think that's been misinterpreted in terms of minimizing the impact of those drugs, and that's certainly not the case. Immune checkpoint blockade has transformed the way that we treat metastatic urothelial cancer. It's just that only about 25% of patients respond to single-agent therapy. We can't pick those patients very well. And so if you have chemotherapy that works in a higher proportion of patients but probably not as well, it's hard to recommend a drug that works in a lower proportion of patients because you might miss your window of opportunity. So we learned that from a few studies. Early second-line therapy, that is switch maintenance, works well. That became a standard. Combination CTLA-4 blockade plus immune checkpoint blockade. We really, same struggle that we're having with single-agent therapy. You're going to see results from CheckMate 901 at this meeting. Eagerly awaited data, doublet immune checkpoint blockade. It works well in a subset of patients, but we don't know exactly who those patients are. And of course, combination platinum-based chemotherapy plus immune checkpoint blockade. We saw two phase 3 studies. This strategy of taking the drugs that you were using in other solid tumors and just adding immune checkpoint blockade just didn't work in bladder cancer. There's maybe some biological or immunobiological reasons for that. But if you just take platinum-based chemotherapy and add on immune checkpoint blockade, it didn't work that well. So here's data from EV-302 that Tom presented at ESMO of 2023, now published in the New England Journal of Medicine. And at ESMO of 2023 in the presidential session, two back-to-back presentations which changed standard management for metastatic urothelial cancer again after several decades of without advances. So EV-302, enfortumab vedotin plus pembrolizumab versus platinum-based chemotherapy. Frontline metastatic urothelial cancer, patients could be cisplatin eligible or ineligible. You see the overall survival benefit here, a tremendous effect size with a hazard ratio of 0.47. This has become standard care based on these results. And here's the PFS, equally impressive effect size. Here's the response rates. So response rates almost 70% in frontline metastatic urothelial cancer. This has been remarkably consistent from the phase 1 to the randomized phase 2 to the phase 3 setting. with this regimen, and CR rates of 30% in metastatic urothelial cancer, really quite impressive. Here's the toxicity profile, very different than chemotherapy. For those of you who have experience with this regimen, there's a learning curve. You have to watch blood sugars. There's a package insert cap for dosing enfortumab on that day based on blood sugar. Blood sugar is greater than 250. You have to hold the dose. Patients could become hyperglycemic even if they don't have diabetes. Not very common, but something to look out for. There's rash, which is common, but sometimes serious, and peripheral neuropathy as a dose-related cumulative side effect. Here's longer-term follow-up data from EV-302 that Tom presented at ASCO GU. So now with a median of 2.5 years of follow-up, and you can see the results are remarkably consistent. And you see that sort of tail on the curve when we're looking out 24 months a 37% progression-free survival rate at 2 years is something that we really weren't talking about in bladder cancer 15 years ago or 10 years ago. And here's the duration of response. So if you have a response with EV Pembro, then your likelihood of maintaining that response at 2 years is quite high. CheckMate 901 presented at the same session at ESMO. This is a really two randomized phase three studies in one. So here I'm talking about the randomization between GemCis nivolumab versus GemCis. I already told you that taking platinum-based chemotherapy and adding immune checkpoint blockade didn't work that well. Those were studies that included, quote-unquote, platinum-based chemotherapy. So it could be carbo or cis, all comers. The distinction with this study is that it only included cisplatin. And when you only include cisplatin and add PD-1 blockade, you improve overall survival. You can see here hazard ratio of 0.78. This is now published in the New England Journal of Medicine, also approved for frontline use in metastatic urothelial cancer. Here's the PFS data, effect size really quite similar. And here's the response rate data. And here we have a CR rate of 20% in metastatic urothelial cancer, an overall response rate of 57.6%. And here's the toxicity data from this study. And like you might have seen in other solid tumors where you add immune checkpoint blockade to chemotherapy, you have the side effects related to immune checkpoint blockade. You have the side effects related to chemotherapy. There does not seem to be synergistic side effects when you combine these classes of drugs. I mentioned two quote-unquote actionable alterations in urothelial cancer. And one of those is FGFR. We've already heard from Dr. Necki, FGFR3 is altered in metastatic urothelial cancer, mostly activating hotspot mutations, which result in constitutive activation of this receptor tyrosine kinase. There are also gene fusions seen in a smaller subset of patients. If you look at metastatic disease, and most of the data is derived from their primary muscle-invasive bladder cancers, probably about 20% of patients have FGFR3 alterations. This phase three THOR study really was an elegantly designed phase three study at the time because it was meant to both demonstrate in a randomized fashion the benefit of erdafitinib in metastatic disease, but also try and answer a question about sequencing that was a major question at the time. It turns out with the development of EV Pembro, the sequencing question's not as relevant anymore. But at the time, it was really relevant. That is, in a patient who had received platinum-based chemotherapy and immune checkpoint blockade, should that patient get erdafitinib or dealer's choice chemotherapy? And you can see here there's a benefit to getting erdafitinib in that setting if your patient has an FGFR3 alteration, both from the standpoint of overall survival or progression-free survival. However, and you see the response rate's much higher with erdafitinib than chemotherapy in this setting, 45.6%. However, if your patient received platinum-based chemotherapy but hadn't received immune checkpoint blockade yet, even though the response rate is still similar with erdafitinib, you see the crossing of the curves there and not a overall survival benefit versus Pembro in this setting. And so this really taught us that immune checkpoint blockade plus platinum-based chemotherapy probably should be used first before erdafitinib, although, again, with EV Pembro, that's become a lesser important issue. HER2 alterations, HER2 mutations are actually not uncommon in urothelial cancer. HER2 amplifications are not uncommon. HER2 overexpression, though, is probably most relevant. HER2 overexpression is seen in about 80% of patients with urothelial cancer at the 1-plus or higher level. Therapies trying to address HER2 kinase activation in urothelial cancer have been largely unsuccessful, but antibody drug conjugates directed against HER2 were seeing much more promising results. So patients with metastatic urothelial cancer were included in the DESTINY-PanTumor02 study, and here's T-DXd in metastatic urothelial cancer. In patients with 2-plus or 3-plus expression, a response rate of 39% in heavily pretreated patients. Patients with 3-plus overexpression, a response rate of 56%. This is approved now as part of the basket indication for trastuzumab deruxtecan. So all of your patients with metastatic urothelial cancer should have FGFR3 alteration testing based on next-generation sequencing or PCR, and they should have HER2 expression testing based on immunohistochemistry. Other anti-HER2-based ADCs are rapidly coming. We've seen data combining disitamab vedotin. So this is an MMAE payload linked to an antibody that's distinct from trastuzumab, binds to a different domain on HER2. We see data combining that with a PD-1 inhibitor from a study done in China with a response rate of 73%. And a smaller lead-in cohort from an international study combining disitamab vedotin plus pembrolizumab with a very similar response rate. So this regimen is being investigated now in a large phase 3 randomized study. The last drug that I want to touch on is just a teaser. In everything that I've showed you so far, except arguably for FGFR3, is based on maybe the expression of a target or drugs that are used in other diseases or targeting the tumor microenvironment. We have very little therapies in urothelial cancer trying to address urothelial cancer-specific biology. Even though we've learned a lot about it, our drugs really don't address that. So PPAR gamma is activated in the vast majority of luminal-like bladder cancers. Luminal-like bladder cancers account for the vast majority of metastatic urothelial cancer. And we've had trouble targeting PPAR gamma, and that's in part because PPAR gamma antagonists actually only disrupt ligand-activated PPAR gamma signaling, not basal PPAR gamma signaling. And so there's been some elegant medicinal chemistry that's developed these inverse agonists, which essentially recruit co-repressors to the complex, which result in decreased activation, even basal downstream signaling from PPAR gamma. So FX-909 is PPAR gamma inverse agonist, now completed dose escalation and dose expansion in luminal-like advanced urothelial cancers. So I'm going to stop there, and we'll talk about a few discussion questions and see if we have time for audience questions as well. So thank you. So a patient with metastatic urothelial cancer who's 65 years old has a good performance status, no prior systemic therapy. What's the first line standard treatment for patients who have an FGFR3 alteration or those who don't? And I don't think we need to spend a whole lot of time on this one because you could see everyone voted the same way, regardless of the presence of an alteration or not. Now, there's some interesting data that's been presented from a small ETCTN study, so a study being done through the U.S. Cooperative Group Phase 1 network, combining erdafitinib with enfortumab vedotin in patients with mutated FGFR3, with tumors harboring mutated FGFR3, showing a response rate of 100% in a very small cohort. So maybe in the future for upfront treatment of patients with FGFR3 alterations, this will change. But for now, EV Pembra. What would you recommend for a 65-year-old patient with metastatic urothelial cancer who progresses on first-line EV Pembro? Tom, what would you do?
No one really knows the answer to this question. In EV-302, most patients ended up getting platinum-based chemotherapy. There's some data, Jonathan Rosenberg and the Memorial Group are presenting some data here from a real-world experience of platinum chemotherapy after EV Pembro, and actually the results look pretty good. I would go with that. If you want to go with erdafitinib in those FGFR altered tumors, we had an ESMO guidelines meeting recently and people went with that. I personally don't necessarily think it's better than platinum-based chemotherapy. It's never been tested. Just because the alteration's there doesn't mean you need to chase it. I asked 30 colleagues around the world. We did a sort of something called a Euromigo score, and the reality is I think most people don't know the answer to these questions. They're all reasonable options. Erdafitinib, although it's oral, is associated with significant toxicity. Don't get me wrong, platinum-based chemotherapy is too. But nevertheless, just because the alteration's there doesn't mean you have to chase it in this setting.
Thank you. And thanks, everyone, for your attention today. I think we're going to wrap this up so you could get over to ASCO. Thank you.
Thank you.